Breathing in, I invite Jesus and the Holy Spirit to breathe in with me. Jesus and I breathe in the kingdom. I am alive. Jesus is alive in me. Breathing in, I invite the Buddha or one of my other spiritual ancestors to breathe in with me. Buddha and I, we have the pleasure of breathing in and breathing out a lot of joy. Buddha is alive. I am alive. I take refuge in the Buddha, and the Buddha takes refuge in me. Breathing in, I establish myself in the present moment. Breathing out, I know this is a wonderful moment. Dear friends, today is March 5th in the year 2011. The fifth mantra. The fifth mantra is this. This is a happy moment. With mindfulness, we can always make the present moment a moment of happiness. This is doable. It's possible. With mindfulness, we can recognize the conditions of happiness that are available, and that recognition can come up. So mindfulness, the energy of mindfulness, is a golden energy. It allows us to be happy in the present moment because mindfulness has the power to recognize the presence of conditions of happiness that are available here and now. That's why we always say that mindfulness is the source of happiness. And we know how to generate this energy of mindfulness. The word smriti, sati in Sanskrit or Pali, is mindfulness. I'm the one who chose to translate those words as mindfulness. Before that, the people used the word attention for smriti or sati, but I used the word mindfulness. Sati in Pali or Smriti in Sanskrit. So a good practitioner, being a practitioner, we should have that power, that capacity to transform any moment into a moment of happiness. Wherever we are. Wherever you are, you can generate the energy of mindfulness to recognize the conditions of happiness that exist. And we see that the moment is worth living. Moment after moment, happiness is possible. So, sitting around the table during a tea ceremony, outside sitting on the grass, we can recite the fifth mantra. Dear friend, this is a moment of happiness. The sky is blue. I'm still alive. You're still alive. There's so many positive things. The fifth mantra. We should practice it several times a day. Holding a cup of tea, we can practice the mantra with mindfulness. Starting your car, you can breathe in. And you can practice this mantra. Happiness is possible right now, today, in this very moment. We have already learned the first mantra, and we can practice these mantras in French or English. The first mantra is, I'm here for you. My dear, I'm here for you. With an in-breath in mindfulness, you bring your mind back to your body, you become fully present, and your presence is a gift to the other person. My dear, I'm here for you. It's easy. Easily, quickly done. Thanks to mindfulness, you can offer this gift. Your own presence. Offer that to your loved ones. We should practice it often, even with the telephone. Darling, I'm here for you. This is for generating your concentrated presence, a beautiful presence, the quality of your presence is produced by the quality of your breathing, the relaxation in your body. And this is something we can all do. The second mantra. My dear, I know you're there. And I'm so happy. You're present. And you affirm the presence of the other person. You can use your cell phone to do this. Darling, I know you're there. And it's a happiness. It's so easy. Who says that meditation is difficult? It's not a chore, it's a pleasure. To sit and practice these mantras. So the second mantra is to recognize the presence of your loved one. Your beloved may be the moon, the planet Earth, the Sangha. And when the other person feels embraced by the energy of your mindfulness, they bloom like a flower. Your attention, your mindfulness, it's like waves embracing. Embraced by your mindfulness, your attention, your loved one will bloom like a flower. The other person is sitting next to you. You're driving the car. You can practice. Darling, I know you're there. On my right-hand side. I'm very happy. The third mantra used when you notice that something is not right, not well with your loved one. She suffers, he suffers. And because you are there, you're aware of the pain that's there in your loved one. So you practice mindful breathing to be really there. And you can come to him or her and you practice the third mantra. My dear, I know you suffer, and that's why I'm here for you. I offer you my presence. That is the most important thing to do when your loved one is suffering. And we can also use our cell phone for this, to practice the mantra. You don't need to recite this mantra in Sanskrit or Pali. You can recite it in English. Before you even do anything for the other person, there's already a relief because you're there. You're aware of that person's suffering. If you suffer and your loved one doesn't know it, you suffer much more. So if your beloved knows you're suffering, you suffer less. So the relief comes very quickly. The mantras are very effective. I know they are because I practice them always. The fourth mantra is the most difficult mantra to practice. But with mindfulness and with love, you can practice it easily. It's in the case where you are suffering and you think that your loved one is the cause of your suffering. If some other person had done the same thing to you or said the same thing to you, you would have suffered much less. But in this case, it's not some other person. It's the person you love the most in the world who said that to you, who did that to you. And that's why you suffer enormously. So you want to go in your room and lock the door and cry all alone. And we also have the tendency to want to punish that person because he or she dared to make you suffer. usually happens is that you want to say, directly or indirectly, I can survive very well, I don't need you. That's what you want to say. That's how you punish the other person, to show you can survive very well without him or without her. And everyone has the same tendency. And if the other person notices something isn't right with you, they come. They ask you what's wrong, and you say, everything's fine. Nothing's wrong. Am I suffering? Why? Why should I be suffering? And if he comes and puts his hand on your shoulder, you say, leave me alone. It means you want to say, I don't need you, I can survive on my own. That's the natural reaction. It's a kind of punishment. And you keep your pain, your suffering in you for a long time because of this, because you want to punish. You want to punish your beloved. The practice that we offer our friends in Plum Village is to come back to the breathing, to walking meditation, to come back and generate mindfulness. Maybe there's a wrong perception on your part. Maybe the other person didn't mean to hurt you, didn't mean to make you suffer. You have that perception. That they did it on purpose. So you have to look. Maybe there's been a misunderstanding. So with mindfulness, with concentration, you look deeply into your pain, whether it may be coming from a wrong perception, a misunderstanding. Unskillfulness, lack of skillfulness, of flexibility. And during the time that you look, you don't say anything. You don't do anything. You just breathe, walk, and look deeply. And maybe after several minutes or hours, you will discover the cause of your pain, and you can get out of that pain, that suffering. But if 24 hours have already gone by, and the pain is still there, then you can do this. You can say three things. You can say them directly. In a peaceful voice. Or if you're not able to speak in a calm way, then you can write these down on a piece of paper. There are three things that you should say. The first thing is, my dear, I'm suffering. And I want you to know, you suffer. You let your beloved know what's going on in you. This is a normal thing to do. When you began, you promised to share everything, right? The happiness and the suffering. So that's what this is about. You're sharing your suffering. Darling, I'm suffering. I'm angry at you. And I want you to know, to speak the truth about the suffering. And if you can bring yourself to write that, or say that, then right away you suffer less. At least a little bit less. Darling, I'm suffering and I want you to know. Tell him, write him, send an email. The second thing to say, I'm doing my best. That means you're a practitioner. You're not just like anybody. When you're angry, you know what you should do and what you should not do. What you're doing is practicing deep breathing, walking meditation, and looking into the nature of your anger, your suffering, to be able to understand. And thanks to that practice, you can get out of the difficulty. You are doing your best to practice. Darling, I'm doing my best. The other person will understand that you are practicing. And the other person will be proud of you. You're not just like anybody else. When you are taken over by anger, you know what to do to handle that anger. And that will inspire respect in the other person. So the second sentence, darling, I'm doing my best. It means I can succeed We then move to the third sentence, which is, please help me. Because I have not been able to free myself of this by myself, I need some help. And you are the person who can help me. You share the pain, the suffering. You ask help. This is normal to do. And if you can bring yourself to write this third sentence, you suffer much less right away, I promise you. Because you have been able to overcome your pride. You don't want to punish the other person anymore. When the other person gets your note, he or she will practice. What did I say? What did I do? And that's meditation. And if the other person discovers what it is, they will come and try to help you get out as soon as possible because they love you. And if you find the answer before the other person does, you can let them know so that he or she can not worry anymore. So our friends who visit Plum Village, they like to use a little piece of paper like this, size of a credit card. They write these three sentences down, and they put the piece of paper in their wallet. And whenever you feel the suffering come up, and you think your suffering was created by your beloved, you pull out that piece of paper and you read it. That's the Buddha right there in your wallet. And you know exactly what you should do and what you should not do. Darling, I'm suffering. And I want you to know, darling, I'm doing my best. Darling, help me. It's simple. This is the Dharma, and it works. It works very well. So the five mantras have been transmitted to you. And with the practice of the five mantras, we can reconcile and be happy in every moment of our daily life. I think we should teach children this practice. I have taught young Chinese and Japanese children these mantras. They wrote them down in Chinese, in Japanese, in order to learn them by heart. In daily life, we express ourselves in the form of thinking, speech, and action. These are the products of human living. A thought is already an action. That's why the Buddha recommended the practice of right thinking as part of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right thinking is thinking that goes in the direction of non-discrimination. Non-division, unity, in the direction of interbeing. Right thinking is thinking that goes in the direction of understanding, compassion, love. as a practitioner, we can always, in every moment, produce right thinking. A thought of compassion, a thought of understanding. With mindfulness, with concentration, we can always, always produce a thought of understanding, of compassion. Because that thought, after having been produced, can heal you, and you can also heal the world with right thinking. A thought of compassion, of understanding, of non-discrimination, after having been produced, begins to heal your body and your mind. And it also begins healing the world. A thought of hatred destroys your body, destroys your mind, and destroys the world. So a thought of compassion, of reconciliation, of understanding, heals your mind and your body. You are your own healer if you can produce thoughts like that, and many times a day. Nothing but compassion, only reconciliation. And then anger is no longer possible with this kind of practice. Just like an orange tree produces orange flowers, humans produce thinking. We can produce right, beautiful, compassionate thinking. And that is our continuation. Oranges and the orange seeds are the continuation of the orange tree. So karma, action, it is our continuation. And thought is the product. It's our action. If your thinking is beautiful, true, then you will have a beautiful continuation. That's why we should try at every moment to produce beautiful thoughts, right thinking. This is an art. Because right thinking brings right speech. We can always say something that will reconcile, inspire confidence, joy, and a word can also destroy, but a word can also save. It can reconcile. And as practitioners, we should be able to produce those kinds of words several times every day. With the Sangha, with the Sangha's help, we can always produce words like that. Whether spoken words, or in a letter, or an email, this is doable. You have generosity in you, and that generosity, that compassion, expresses itself through your speech. What you say is action. That's karma, and that is your continuation. You are continued by your thoughts and your words, and you can continue in beauty. And your physical act, thoughts, bodily actions. That isn't the third kind of action. If your action, your bodily action, is to protect, to save, to support, that is right action. That's a good action. That is the action of compassion, of understanding. To save an insect, to save a plant, to save a child, to save a person who's sick, to save our planet, that's right action. You have a good intention, you have love in you, so that action of compassion is always possible several times a day for you as a practitioner. You should become a bodhisattva who helps the world. When Jean-Paul Sartre says that man is the sum of his acts, it sounds very close to Buddhism. And his acts here, it means physical acts, like, as well as speech and thinking. For thinking to be right thinking, benevolent, compassionate, for speech and bodily acts to be compassionate, you need to have right view. Right view. That's why in Buddhism, right view is the foundation of all right thinking, all right speech, and all right action. The path recommended by the Buddha begins with right view. Right view. We can say right away that this is the insight with no discrimination. There is no more separation. Body and mind, for example. You think that body is something different from mind. There's a duality. We ask ourselves, we can ask ourselves, is it the body that generates the mind, or is it the mind that generates the body? But it's like the left and the right. Did the left create the right, or did the right create the left? The left is not possible without the right. The right is not possible without the left. So the two manifest together, and we can see the unity. If you are a scientist, you have already noticed, you've observed. That science is looking towards unity, the unification, unified theory. There's electricity and magnetism. These have become the same thing. Electromagnetic force, space, matter, have become the same thing. Time and space have become the same thing. Without this, that cannot be. This is a march towards unity, non-discrimination, and science and spirituality can go very well together. David Bohm talked about an implicate order. Implicate order. As distinct from the explicate order. In the explicate order, things exist outside of each other. You are outside of me, and the sun is outside the tree. But if you look deeply, you see that the Father is in the Son is in the Father, and the Son is in the tree. In the beginning, we see the mud and the lotus as two separate things. And they appear to be antagonistic. One is so beautiful and fragrant, and the other is so yucky and smelly. But if we look deeply, we see the lotus in the mud, and we see the mud in the lotus. So in the explicate order, we see things as existing outside of each other, separate. But when we look deeply, in the implicate order, we see that things exist within each other. They interpenetrate, they inter-are. In Buddhism, we use the word interbeing. You are in me, and I'm in you. We inter-are. In the Christian tradition, if you speak of the Trinity, you can also see the Son in the Father in the Son, the Holy Spirit as the energy. Without the Holy Spirit, the Father is not the Father, and the Son is not the Son. You cannot be by yourself alone. You have to interbe with everything. And if you manage to see things like that, then you have right view. There's no more discrimination. There's no north, south, black and white. The left is not the enemy of the right. We inter-are. And if we have that insight, then war is no longer possible. And meditation is aimed at seeing reality in its nature of interbeing, of interdependence. So right thinking is thinking that is based on right view. That's why that's what makes deep understanding and compassion possible. Right thinking. From right view, there is right thinking. And with meditation, with our looking into reality, we discover the nature of interbeing, of interdependence. Son and Father are not enemies. the Father's in the Son, and the Son is in the Father. If the Father is suffering, there's no way that the Son can be truly happy. We have to help the Father not to suffer, and then the Son will be happy. So that is right thinking based on right view. And based on right view, there's also right speech. Right speech does not contain discrimination, only reconciliation, harmony, compassion. Then, right action. Action of the body, aimed at reconciliation, aimed at saving, protecting. So the teaching, in the teaching of the Buddha, thinking, speech, and action are based on right view. Right view is the product of meditation. Insight is possible thanks to concentration. Right concentration. And that concentration is born from mindfulness. Mindfulness carries within it concentration. When mindfulness and concentration are strong, there's a breakthrough into reality, and the insight into reality is what gives us right view. And what saves us here is recognition, wisdom, insight. We can very well describe this insight as a kind of grace. The greatest grace is understanding. It liberates us. That is true salvation. If you live every moment of your life in mindfulness, it's because you are a practitioner, a diligent practitioner. So diligence, this is right effort. And after right action, before diligence, there's the other factor, which is called right livelihood. So you see, this Buddhist teaching is not just for monks and nuns, it's for everyone. You who have a job, livelihood, a career, an occupation that allows us to express our love, our compassion, our understanding through our thoughts, our speech, and our actions. And if you have a job that gives you the opportunity to express yourself every day in terms of understanding and compassion, then you are a happy person. And even if you have a lower salary, but you can practice in this way, the happiness will be much greater. So this is the path proposed by the Buddha. He lived this and he shared this path with us. Right thinking, right speech, right action, right livelihood, mindfulness, concentration, these always continue to nourish and enrich right view. Insight becomes deeper, always deeper through this practice of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold, Noble Eightfold Path is a path that leads to the cessation, the ending of suffering. It's a path that leads to true happiness. This is the fourth noble truth, the fourth of the four noble truths. Fourth noble truth is the path. And this path leads to the cessation of suffering. Which means the presence of happiness. It's the same thing. The ending of suffering is the presence of happiness. If you remove ignorance, something will replace the ignorance. That's knowledge, awareness. If you take away darkness, what is there is light. So to understand the third noble truth, cessation of suffering, it means the presence of happiness. I think for today's youth, it would be better to use the word presence of happiness than cessation of suffering. The second noble truth is also a kind of path. So the fourth truth is the noble Eightfold Path, the noble path that leads to happiness. The second truth is it's not noble at all. It's ignoble. It's the ignoble path. Greed, hatred, violence, these constitute the ignoble path leading to suffering. The first truth is suffering. Second truth, the way of living that leads to the suffering. The opposite of right view, the opposite of right thinking. That's also a path, but it is not a noble path. So the five mindfulness trainings that you received this morning represent in a very concrete way the path. They represent the Buddha's teaching on the Four Noble Truths. They also represent the noble path, the Noble Eightfold Path, aimed at transforming suffering and establishing happiness. Sharing the practice. To share the practice with your friend is possible, because if you put into practice the Buddha's teaching, you become a happy, open, loving person. And with all of that, you can very well help your loved ones to follow the path. You don't need to give sermons to convert them. Your way of living will show the way, and the other person will follow, because they also want to go in the direction of happiness, brotherhood and sisterhood. So after having received the five mindfulness trainings, you're invited to look around you. Recognize the elements with which you can build a sangha in your neighborhood, in your town. Building a sangha is the most noble thing that you can do. A beloved community, it is with the sangha that you can do things. If you want to save our planet, we have to have a beloved community, a sangha. And that beloved sangha protects you, inspires you, and together you put into practice what the Buddha transmitted to us, and you live in such a way that a future can be possible for our children and their children. And this five mindfulness trainings don't have to be in Buddhist terms. You can inspire others who practice in other traditions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, to do the same in their own tradition. That they go deeply into their tradition and offer the equivalent of the five mindfulness trainings. We are sure if we practice the five mindfulness trainings, happiness will be possible, and our planet will be safe and sound. With your loved one, you can walk in the kingdom of God, in the pure land of the Buddha, in the space of freedom. Buddhism is about freedom, true freedom. imagine there is a level of reality called being. Being. I am, you are, they are, there is being. There are theologians who say that God is the ground of being. That was Paul Tillich. But if being is there, then non-being also has to be there. It's just like when the left is there, then the right also has to be there. So this layer of reality has to include both being and non-being. And what I'm wondering is, if God is the ground of being, then who will be the ground of non-being? Satan? The devil? This is a notion of an enemy. It's a dualistic view. And as we have practiced looking deeply together, we can already see that nothing can be by itself. Everything has to interbe with everything else. That is our vision. Look at it, look into this flower. Is this flower able to be here by itself? No, if there's no sun. If there had been no rain, no earth, would it be possible for this flower to have manifested? No. If we take out the sun, if we take out the rain, if we take out the earth from this flower, there's no more flower. So it's true that this flower cannot be by itself. It has to interbe with the sun, interbe with the clouds. So the verb interbe is much closer to reality than just be. So being is a wrong perception. It's a notion. And that notion is accompanied by the opposite notion of non-being. And we're afraid of non-being because of being. Non-being is there. And that is the cause of a lot of fear, the idea of non-being, non-existing. According to the Buddha, being and non-being are nothing but notions, just ideas that exist only in our head. In reality, there is no being and no non-being. In absolute reality, absolute reality is free of these concepts, just like God is. So, God is the foundation of being. That doesn't make sense, because then who is the foundation of the non-being? God transcends being and non-being. There are Christian mystics who have understood this. And we're able to see. So meditation consists of looking deeply to be able to break through this curtain, pierce the veil, and arrive at the view of interbeing. the inside of interbeing. This is the implicate order of David Bohm. There's no more separation. Things inter are. Modern science, quantum physics, has begun to use expressions like superposition, but the word interbeing is much better. Superposition, things being stacked on top of each other, non-locality, here and there, two different things. In the light of interbeing, here contains there. Modern science is talking about this matter of non-locality, superposition. This has come very close to the Buddhist view. So we don't need sophisticated instruments. We don't need accelerators that cost lots of money. All we need is mindfulness and concentration to be able to see. Western science and Eastern intuition are coming together, and they can work together. The most important instrument is our own mind. Even with the most sophisticated instruments, you still have to use your mind. And if you're more attentive, more concentrated, then you can discover. So from being and non-being, we can go to the reality of interbeing, and ultimately we enter into the ultimate dimension, nirvana. Nirvana is the ultimate dimension. There are two dimensions to reality. There's the historical dimension, and the historical dimension is the one we live in everyday life. There is birth, there is death, time and space, and so on. There's a lot of fear and anxiety if we live only in the historical dimension. But if we have the time to look more deeply, we can touch the deeper reality, which is the ultimate dimension, and it is not separate from the historical dimension. It's the same, it's like the wave and the water. When we can touch the wave, we touch the water. When the wave goes up, there is joy. When the wave falls, there may be fear of non-being, of the end in the historical dimension. The wave living in the historical dimension. But we know very well that the wave can also live in the ultimate dimension. If the wave turns back towards herself, she discovers that she is water. She's no longer afraid. The rise is joyful and the fall is just as joyful. Once you realize that you are water, so it is possible to live your life as a wave or as water and as water at the same time. That is the work of the practitioner. The practitioner lives the historical dimension. She uses a calendar. He sleeps at night, he works in the day. But he touches deeply this reality, the ultimate dimension. She discovers birth and death don't truly exist, like being and non-being. It doesn't really exist. Reality transcends notions of being and non-being. God, Nirvana. Birth is seen as the arrival of something from non-being into being. You go from non-existence into existence. Before that, there's nothingness, it's the void. Non-being, and now there's being. To be born is from nothing, we become something. That's our way of seeing things. To be born is that from nobody we suddenly become somebody. And we need to prove it with a birth certificate. Before, that person didn't exist, but now she has begun to exist. But that is not right view. Nothing can go from non-being into being. Find me something that came from non-being. You won't find it. The cloud that you see in the sky, you may say it was born, but and before its manifestation as a cloud, it didn't exist, but that's not true. In its previous life, in its former life, the cloud was heat, ocean water. This is a new manifestation, but it's not a birth, because birth means from nothing becoming something. From no one, we become someone. And death, similarly, means that from something or someone, you become nothing, no one. This is impossible. The scientist Lavoisier said, nothing is created and nothing is lost. That means there is no birth, there is no death. And Lavoisier, as a scientist, looked deeply into things. He discovered no birth, no death. Just as we speak about in the Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita in Buddhism. So not only being and non-being are mere notions, concepts, but birth and death are also notions. Because in our mind we think that to be born means that from non-being you pass into being. And when you die, you pass from being into non-being. This is the cause of our fear and our anxiety. It's insight that can save you from that fear, liberate you from that fear of the void. Nirvana, So nirvana is the absence, the extinction of all notions, including the notion of being or non-being, birth, death. And this dimension of reality, we can touch it with our meditation, with looking deeply. We don't need sophisticated instruments. The word nirvana, or nibbana in Pali, it used to be a very commonplace word. It had to do with the kitchen. In the old times, they cooked with wood fires. And they cooked over straw fires. Or leaves. When the fire had not yet gone out, we were still at risk of burning our hands if we touched the ashes. Nibbana referred originally to the time when the fire had gone out, it was extinguished. And you could no longer get burned. What burns you is anger, is discrimination, is anxiety, is fear, is the afflictions. It's the afflictions that burn us. It is ignorance that burns us. Nirvana is the extinction of all those things. All the notions. So nirvana is coolness, the cooling, the absence of the fire that can burn us. The fire has gone out. Coolness. I think the word coolness can be used to translate nirvana. Coolness, freshness. Cooling. So, this can eliminate all our notions of being, non-being, birth and death, etc., coming and going. And then fear is no longer there, anxiety is no longer there. We are free, we can enjoy the ultimate dimension of nirvana, and nirvana is not something that belongs to the future. Nirvana is right now, it's right here. Because the wave doesn't need to run into the future to find water. She is water. You have been nirvanized for a long time already. So with insight, you can touch the ultimate dimension in you, your true nature of no birth and no death. And when we come to a practice center, we can get the relief. We suffer less. The greatest relief is only obtained when you can touch your nature of nirvana. Nirvana is available in the here and now. It is not something to seek in the future. You're there. You belong to that dimension, the ultimate dimension, to this reality that is called suchness. Suchness, we can use other words. Suchness. So with the instrument of mindfulness of concentration, we can live in a way that lets us get deeply in touch with reality. And if we can see the interbeing nature of things, being and non-being disappear to become nirvana. Nirvana here, and not only over there. So insight, right view, is essential, and that is the goal of the meditation practitioner. In Christianity, we may think of the Holy Spirit as the energy of God. And if the energy of God is there, then there is wisdom, there is love, healing, transformation. And if we look with Buddhist eyes, we can see that the Holy Spirit is mindfulness, concentration, and right view. If you have that energy of mindfulness, of concentration, insight, right view, then there is transformation, there is healing and happiness right away. It doesn't come from outside, it comes from us. It is possible to generate mindfulness, to generate concentration, to attain insight on our own. And we know very well that every in-breath in mindfulness, every step taken in mindfulness, has an effect. Immediately. One in-breath in mindfulness gives rise to the energy of mindfulness. It helps you to be there, concentrated, to be able to get in touch with the wonders of life. And if you continue, you can get deeply in touch with what is there, to touch the ultimate dimension, God or Nirvana. And if you are inhabited by that peace, by that non-fear, you are free. And you can help a lot of people to do the same. Every one of us can be motivated by that intention inspired by that intention to build a Sangha. That is the aspiration, the vow of every practitioner. If you have peace and joy in yourself, naturally, you want to share them. And the best way to share them is to build a Sangha. You need a Sangha to continue. The Sangha needs you. If you have a Sangha, it will be a refuge for many people to come to transform and also to save our planet. As a practitioner, you have that mind of love, bodhicitta, that energy. Love is an energy. You want to help people suffer less. You want to save this planet. That's love. And you know very well that to express that love, you can build a Sangha. Live. Love. Live understanding. That is the only way to realize your aspiration, your vow, your intention. Dear friends, it has been wonderful to be able to live together this Dharma during 1 week. We are a beautiful Sangha, a beloved community. And we will continue tomorrow, the next day. This morning, some young brothers and sisters just left for the United Kingdom, England. These young monks and nuns. They've just gone to Bergerac to get on a plane for England. Here's the poster for what they're going to offer. Wake up. This is aimed for young people. Three sisters and four brothers are going to be offering events for young people in different colleges and universities in England. Brighton on the 15th of March. They'll be at the Friends Meeting House. They're going to practice with the young people in England. From 6 to 8 p.m. at that particular event. They will also go to Imperial College before, on March 8. The 9th and 10th at Leeds University, the 11th and 12th. London School of Asian Studies, Oxford, 15th, Sussex, and the 17th, Cambridge University, 19th to the 21st, is a weekend retreat, 3-day retreat for young people. So this is what we do as a community. When you go back home, you know what you can do to continue the practice. And we have made a good start here this week. With your talent, your initiative, your energy, you will be able to organize practice in your family, in your community, and help people to suffer less, to taste the joy of living. I ask the monastics to come up, and also the Order of Interbeing members to come up. We're going to sing a song together to celebrate our presence together. This is a moment of happiness. Fifth mantra. This is a happy moment. Monastics, please come up. Dear friends, before we offer the song, I would like to announce to you that in New Hamlet, we have 67 sisters. In Lower Hamlet, 55 sisters. In Upper Hamlet, 80 brothers. We need a French teacher in every hamlet. And that teacher will be paid in food. Maybe a little pocket money. We can only pay pocket money. But if you love the practice, you can come and go. But we need 4 volunteer teachers, because it's really shameful that so many of us are living here in France without speaking French. And you know the brothers and sisters are very nice, but they don't speak French, and that's really a pity. So we need volunteers. We never know. Maybe there's somebody here who would like to stay for 3 months. And the brothers and sisters if any brother or sister doesn't go to your class, they have to pay 1 euro each time. Every time they miss your class, they have to pay 1 euro. Pai is asking them to sing No Coming, No Going.
You can go, Pai. You can go.
No, here is
Everyone can stand up and sing together.
si vous voulez perdre quelques kilos, c'est mieux la retraite. Alors on y va, descendez.
If you want to lose some weight, you can come to the health retreat at Lower Hamlet. You will not eat very much and you'll walk a lot.